Hello everyone and welcome to episode 610 of So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast that's all about writing and publishing. My name's Valerie Koo. I'm CEO of the Australian Writers' Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses, and I'm your host. What have you been up to? I have been up to... You know what? I have been playing around a lot with my new retro typewriter. Well, it's not new, but it's new to me. You know, now I may have mentioned it already, but I don't think I had played around with it the last time I spoke about this. I love it. It is an Olympia, and the model is the Traveller Deluxe, and it has its own case. It's great. It looks like something out of Mad Men, or, you know, probably pre-Mad Men, and it's this bright orange and white typewriter that kind of looks like also should be in the Jetsons. I've always wanted an orange one just like this. So I am very lucky, very, very lucky that it has come into my possession because my friend's sister was decluttering and I was able to trade it in exchange for a box of Haig's chocolates. I think I did pretty well. I'm so lucky. I've been clickety-clacking on it every morning, kind of doing an equivalent of morning pages and loving that the way that you can just sort of pull that sheet of paper out of the typewriter once you've come to the final line. I love it. So that has certainly been my latest obsession. And now let's welcome back Nat Newman. Nat, how are you? What's been happening in that world?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you going first? You all right?
I'm well. I've had a lot on. I've been trying to get, you know, cross everything off the list kind of thing. I've had a lot of unfinished creative projects that are, you know, I've said this before, but then what happens is I finish them and then I accumulate more. And so I have, you know, five different creative projects that are at the 90% mark and I need to spend all this time stopping myself from starting anything new because I need to finish it. But then I disappoint myself because I start the thing that's new.
Yeah. isn't there some sort of equation about, you know, you spend 90% of your time on 10% of the project or something like that?
I can't remember. It's so true. Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate, even if it's, you know, not scientific. I think that's pretty accurate. But anyway. Also, if listeners are new to this podcast, Nat is one of the creative writing tutors here at the Australian Writers' Centre, but also an incredible author, writer, storyteller, filmmaker, actor, linguist, a whole number of things.
Yeah.
Anyway, what have you been up to?
What have I been up to? Speaking of acting, I just performed Much Ado About Nothing this weekend.
Oh, wow. Just a bit of Shakespeare. What character were you?
I was Claudio.
Was it hard to remember all those lines with all that language?
Yes, yes, it is. Language. And I'm not going to deny it. There were lots of fires, and that we had to put out on stage, because it is hard. It's very hard to remember all the lines.
But in terms of that memory, in terms of actually committing it to memory, what's your technique?
Repeating it every single day. Is the main thing. But, you know, so people ask that all the time. That's always the big question that actors get asked. How did you remember all the lines? Mm-hmm. But like, if I asked you how many songs you know all the lyrics to, it'd be dozens and dozens and dozens, right? So you just,
different because there's a tune, there's a rhythm, there's a
rhythm to Shakespeare as well.
Yes, I guess so.
Like the whole iambic pentameter thing, like you know, my mistress's eyes are nothing like the sun. Like there's a, yeah. You don't say it like that, but that's how you remember it, you know.
Yeah. Wow. So what was the experience like? Was it, you know, would you play Claudio again?
Yes. Are you kidding me? Actually, I was surprised when I got cast as Claudio because he's a difficult character. Like he doesn't behave very rationally, or it seemed to me. Like I personally would not like Claudio as a person. Mm. Which is kind of what makes him really interesting to play as a character, because you have to find, okay, maybe I don't agree with a lot of his behavior, but I have to find a way to understand it. And so, so that became really interesting. And for me, I like to figure out how a character dances and how they move, how they walk through a door, all those sorts of things. And then through those things, you start to figure out how they exist in the world. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
What would your dream role be? Or it doesn't have to be the dream role, just something, a role that you would really like to play.
Oh gosh, I really don't know. I'd love to be a superhero.
Okay.
I want to run around and save the world.
Because you want to wear a cape?
Well, a cape would be all right, but you know, why not have a, you know, okay, did you watch Eternals?
No,
good, because it was terrible, but
I've heard.
Yeah, but you know, there's something about seeing, like, so I think, I mean, not that Angelina Jolie is particularly old, but seeing a woman in her 40s actually, or she might even be a little bit old. No, I think she's in her 40s.
Really? I thought she was over 50. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Well, she might be, but either way, to see a, you know, a woman who's not 25 and stunning, you know, being a superhero, albeit a very flawed one, it's kind of cool, and you don't see that, you know. I'd love to see some more older women superheroes.
Okay, so
yeah,
be
pick
a
me,
superhero.
Pick me.
Maybe you could be in season 5 of The Boys.
Yes. Sign me up. I'll be there.
All right. So let's move on to your writing tip for us this week.
Yeah, okay. So this one's a fun one. This week I would love to encourage your listeners, Valerie, to get into your creative sandpit.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does
so
that
I
mean?
Think often, yeah, often with writing, you know, you're either writing to a deadline, oh, there's a short story competition coming up, or I want to finish this second draft of my novel or first draft of my novel, or, you know, you're writing an article and again, there's deadlines. But it's really, really important to take the time to just play, you know, set aside at least one of your writing sessions every week to, without any, no expectations, just do some writing, you know, write a few lines, just write what's around you, just chill out with your writing and play around, you know.
So what's your advice then for, because there are people who they will get into a literal sandpit and they have to build a sandcastle. So there are some people who feel that they need a purpose. What's your advice to those people?
You can still have a purpose if that's what's going to help you, but just make your purpose, you know, something a little bit looser. Like, I'm just going to write for 40 minutes. I'm going to write about a flower for 30 minutes. I'm going to, whatever it is, if that's what you need, to help you. I mean, a little bit of structure is never a bad thing. But yeah, but just have fun with it, because I think something a lot of writers maybe don't realize is most of what you write is not going to be published. And so having fun with it and just playing and just writing something just for the hell of it allows you to kind of accept that as well and go, you know what, this does not have to become edited and published one day. I can just write this thing just for the joy of writing.
Something that people can actually check out is Story Seeds, because that is a free series of writing prompts that I send out on the last Thursday of every month in the Australian Writers' Centre newsletter. And you get 30 or 31, depending on the, you know, number of days in the following month, writing prompts. And that's a great thing to do. That's just playing. You don't have to have a big end goal. It's just a series of exercises to see where it goes.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Because I think sometimes even like I love journaling and morning pages and stuff, but even sometimes that can feel, it can feel a bit like work. Like, oh, I better sit down and do my morning pages. I better sit down and journal. I have to do my 3 pages. But, you know, give yourself a break. Just bash out something, you know, be inspired by the story seeds and just see where it takes you.
I love it. Figure out what your creative sandpit is and get in it and get your shovel out and get your bucket out and have some fun.
Hopefully there's no poop in there.
All right. Thanks so much, Nat.
All right. Thanks.
Let's move on to the competition this week. I have 3 copies of The Wrong Man by Tim Iliff to give away. I am a big fan of Tim Iliff, and he has been on the podcast before when we talked about his last novel, Killer, Traitor, Spy. He is also author of The Greater Good, State of Fear, The Enemy Within, and now The Wrong Man. I could tell you all about it, but I thought it would be even better if I asked Tim to give you an idea of what it's about. Here's Tim.
Well, I'm Tim Iliff, and Valerie from the Australian Writers' Centre wanted me to tell you a little bit about my new book, The Wrong Man, which comes out in July. It starts with the murder of a prominent Sydney socialite in the millionaire's playground of Palm Beach. John Bailey's on the case, but so is Holly Sutton, a detective. I just love writing her character. She's tough, she's flawed, and she's driven by that same sense of justice as Bailey. Well, is it long before Bailey and Sutton discover a link between this murder and the death of a waitress at the exclusive Sydney club, a men-only club, about a decade earlier? A serial killer is already serving a jail sentence for that crime because Detective Sharon Dexter, Bailey's old girlfriend, put him there. Well, Bailey owes it to Dexter to find out whether she jailed the wrong man. You're going to meet some really awful people in this book because it's about the very real scourge of violent misogyny. You'll learn about incels, the online community of hateful men who claim they are involuntary celibate, as in they are born unattractive to women. This is a real movement, and some of these men have been behind some very violent crimes. Just like my other books, The Wrong Man can be read as a standalone, and it's out on July 3.
I cannot wait to read this, The Wrong Man by Tim Iliff. I have 3 copies to give away. Entries close on the 8th of July. So just go to writercentre.com.au/win and follow the instructions to enter it. I've made it super easy for you to enter. Go to writercentre.com.au/win to win 1 of 3 copies of The Wrong Man by Tim Iliff. And now, are you ready for the word of the week? Well, I hope you are, because the word of the week is fuscous. F-U-S-C-O-U-S, fuscous. What does it mean? Well, it's an adjective meaning dark, brownish or grey. Fuscous belongs to the very long list of words about colour, and it means dark, brownish, grey. Maybe one day I'll put together a book with all of these colours, you know, like a coffee table book. And I suppose a coffee table is something that could be fuscous. There you go. And that was the word of the week. Now let's move on to our writer in residence this week. Today I'm talking to Kira Geddes. Her novel is The Story Thief. Following a career in marketing, Kira returned to university to study English and pursue her lifelong dream of writing. That's where she got the idea for The Story Thief, which is her debut novel. It's a wonderful retelling inspired by the iconic short story by Henry Lawson, The Drover's Wife, but it's so much more as we follow the main character Lillian through a journey starting with Lillian's realization that she could be one of the characters in that story. Kira also completed courses at the Australian Writer Centre and did an incredible amount of research for this novel. And the result is a wonderful book that I'm certain is going to be a huge success. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kira.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm so excited by your book. Oh my God, The Story Thief. It's so clever. It's such an original voice as well. And it's just such a good idea. For people who haven't got a copy of The Story Thief yet, and they absolutely should, can you tell us what it's about?
All right. Well, The Story Thief, it's my debut historical fiction. It's inspired by Henry Lawson's classic 1892 story, The Drover's Wife, and by its parallel painting by Russell Drysdale. And in my retelling of this story, Lillian is born in 1892 as the daughter of a drover, and she lives in the red dirt country of outback New South Wales. And then after losing her family in a tragic bushfire, she's sent to a convent boarding school in Sydney, where she's takes comfort in books and dreams of an independent life as a teacher. And it's there at school at the age of 16 that she first reads Henry Lawson's story and is immediately struck by the similarities to her own family and becomes quickly convinced that he's based his story upon her family, with her mother as the original but unacknowledged drover's wife. And all of that sets Lillian on a path to search for the truth and reclaim her family's story. And then we follow her journey, I guess you'd say, of love and loss across the first half of the 20th century, which takes us all the way through pivotal events in Australian history, like women's suffrage and 2 world wars, and even the beginning of the nuclear age.
So it is such a clever idea and so well executed. How in the world did this idea for a novel come into your head?
Okay, well, I just have to say thank you so much for that, because I think you've just answered what was probably my greatest ever concern, which would be such a great idea, but did I manage to pull it off? So I'm really glad to hear you say that. So thank you. The idea for The Story Thief started 10 years ago during my university studies at Macquarie. I was studying English and creative writing. And one day in class, we read The Drover's Wife and some of its best known retellings, because there's actually quite a literary history around retelling. So I'm not the first one. But I've probably written the longest retelling of anyone, I suspect.
Because the original was a short story, right?
The original was seven really tightly written pages, and it has spawned a whole sort of mini Australian canon of retellings, which is quite remarkable. And so what struck me about the story, or what really bothered me, if you like, was that in this great story, which was about a bush heroine and all of the amazing things she had to do to survive, even though he was praising her in that way, the drover's wife remained unnamed in the story, as did her two daughters, whereas the two boys in the story were named, and even the family dog was named. So it really was begging for a feminist retelling, for somebody to get in there. And so in my case, rather than tell the story of the drover's wife, my attention went instead to her infant daughter nestled on her mother's left hip. And I just began to imagine her life and of the women to follow in her life. And then the story just went from there.
But when you read the drover's wife and it bothered you that, yes, you know, these women, that the heroine is not acknowledged, the boys have names, the girls don't have names.
Yes. Yes.
And that's something that the character in your novel, Lillian,
yes,
there's a scene where she realizes all of, yes, this as well. So, yes, getting bothered by something is different to deciding to write an entire novel. So tell me, I get bothered by a lot of things, but I don't decide to write, you know, 80 or 100,000 words. So at what point did, yeah, you think, I'm going to write a novel about it?
It actually remarkably early. So, I mean, I'd never written anything beyond a short story. I should say it's always been my lifetime ambition to write a novel. So I was at uni for the purpose of, you know, starting those skills of reading well, which then leads to writing well. And then I complemented that, obviously, with the courses at the AWC. But I hadn't embarked upon a novel before. And so I guess the spark of it was, one, it was that, you know, that feminist kind of spark. The second thing, I think there was something about the story setting which resonated with me, even though it actually took me a few years to work it out. And if anyone's familiar with The Drover's Wife, it is set in, you know, a two-room shack in this unspecified outback location, very remote, very rustic, very basic. And it turns out that my own first 2 years of life were maybe not that dissimilar to that, because my parents, although definitely not drovers, were German immigrants. But we lived, for my first couple of years of life, we were living in the Andamooka opal fields of South Australia. And on my website, if anyone's interested, you can see photos of me quite literally in the red dirt in my playpen. And, you know, with my mother pushing me in the pram. And I think there must have been something about that story setting which just called out to me. And in the end, look, it's inspired by Lawson's story, but that's also just a scaffolding for me to tell the story that I wanted to tell, and in which in many ways is actually inspired by my mum and some of the losses she endured and the comforts she found in life. So, I don't know. It came to me and I came to it. We were meant to be.
So it is the jumping off point, the drover's wife, hearing Lawson's story set in this, you know, out back somewhere. But this is Lillian's story, and Lillian spends a lot of time in Sydney. There's real places. There's the Queen Victoria Building. There's the tea rooms. There's the streets. There's the college or, you know, school that she goes to. And your novel spans quite a number of decades, like from 1900-ish to after the war.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
The amount of change that would have gone on in Australia, in history, the number of, you know, different zeitgeists and different ways of doing things. I need to ask you about the research, because where in the world did you start? Because did you write the story first and think, okay, I need to now go back and make sure I got it correct? Or did you research a whole eras, multiple eras, and then write the story? What came first?
Yeah, it was a bit of both. I started out, so I read that in 2014, and in 2014 and 15, while I was still at uni, I wrote a couple of sample chapters at class, but what I started to do quite quickly was plan out the whole story. And I knew where I wanted it to go, and I really wanted to bring in Russell Drysdale's painting, and I knew I needed to take that to 1954 at the very least, and I won't reveal why. And there is, in fact, potentially more of the story to come, but we can talk about that later. So I had it planned out from an emotional journey viewpoint, from Lillian's story, I did. But then the more that I went along, the more I realised I knew almost nothing about Australian history for each of those eras, which was quite disturbing to me, because I like to have a lot of knowledge. I don't like doing things in a vacuum. And so I created this timeline. I called it my fact fiction timeline. It's all in Scrivener. So thank you for the Scrivener course. And so I would have the fact, which was what was happening in the world and what was happening in Australia in particular years, and then what was happening in the story. And it just got more and more detailed. And I just realized there was so much more I needed to know. So, but even still, I did in the end just start writing chronologically. And so I would just go along era by era. So some of my plan probably changed. I think, you know, certain story points and conflict points developed. And sometimes I would use history to inspire a particular chapter. And other times it went the other way around, where Lillian's story had to be made to fit into history. But I think, yeah, I really was not a historian, but I feel like I've done a little mini degree in Australian history and also in Australian literature, because that was my other approach to research, was actually reading my way into the history. So for me, the greatest truths are always found in fiction, not in history books. And so wherever I was up to in the book, whatever chapter, whatever era, I was reading novels that were written at the time. So when I was writing 1900 and say the boarding school chapters, I was reading Miles Franklin, My Brilliant Career, Henry Handel Richardson, The Getting of Wisdom. So, you know, I let Lillian read those books as well. I couldn't help but put them in there. And then, you know, if I was in the World War II years, I was reading Dimphna Kuzak and Eleanor Dark. That's where I got a lot of the voice, if you like, because I wanted the language to feel as though it came from that time as well. And I really immersed myself in those worlds. And I have to say, I opted out of reading anything other than that. I strictly only read what I was researching. And I kind of opted out of life a little bit too for a while there.
So talk to me about, you said that you planned out the novel, yes, and the key emotional points. What did that look like? Did you plan it out in your head, in a Word document, in an Excel spreadsheet, on index cards? What did that look like?
I think it was a Word document. And I've got so many archive boxes, it's not funny, of all of my planning documents, of all of the different versions that we had. And I'm kind of waiting now that we're published, I can probably go through and chuck out most of it. There was a big thick document it probably wasn't scene by scene, but it was the arc, and it was, I'm trying to think, it would have been sort of structural elements like characterization. So it was actually 2018, I did a course that you guys were hosting at the time with Natasha Lester, How to Write a Bestseller. And that came in, I'd probably done most of my planning, but I actually made some changes after that. So Natasha had done a brilliant job of explaining all of the different elements that go into making a satisfying story, like that you might have, you know, you've got the heroine, but then there might be a very good friend, a mentor, an enemy, You know, these sorts of things. She talked about secrets are often at the heart of a good story or a good page turner. So sometimes I was constantly refining my plan as well, and then just kind of plodding along one chapter at a time. And I mean, chapters would take me months to write. Like, I'm a very, very, very slow writer, I have to say, very slow.
So yeah. Let's talk about those courses briefly, because you've done several courses at the Australian Writers' Centre, and I'm just curious to know, you were already doing or had completed the English degree. Mm. Why did you want to do the courses at the Australian Writers' Centre?
I think just for more practical courses, and just to hone in on the exact skills that I was specifically lacking. So the English degree was brilliant to do what I wanted, which was read well. So you become a very analytical reader. And, you know, the only problem is you come out as a bit of a perfectionist as well, because you're never going to live up to the standard of the sorts of texts that they're studying there. So I did that. And then the creative writing units I did there were my minors. So I, you know, got to do four or five different units. But we were working on short stories, because by necessity, that was all there was room for in the undergraduate degree. But that gives you a lot of confidence, I think, to start with short stories. And I did have a couple of them published at uni. So that was really heartening. And then what I did when I finished, I graduated in 2017, and that was probably when I then sort of turned to the AWC and Scrivener, somebody put me onto. So that's why I started to use that to hold all of the research that I did. And then it was other things like, the bestseller course, as I said, also things like building your author profile, which I'm quite great. I'm very grateful for, actually, for those sorts of tips, because when I started, I think on Instagram 3 years ago, I used to make wisecracks about, you know, what's that thing about if you scream in a forest and no one hears you, did it actually happen? So I thought I was producing great content, but there was nobody looking at it. But I got to practice my voice. And so I'm actually glad that I was plugging away at that for a few years as well, because now it is building. It was the practical help and filling in gaps in my own knowledge that I was looking for at that point. So, yeah, it was very helpful.
You also did a course called Reinvent Yourself, and you have reinvented yourself. Tell us what you were doing before.
Oh, yes. Well, my first career was in marketing. So I worked for 10 years in marketing, particularly direct marketing and loyalty marketing, so credit card rewards programs and things like that. And I absolutely loved it. So it was a general management role by the end of it. But then when I was going to carry on with that work part-time when we started a family, but that's actually, my husband got moved to Melbourne with his job, and that was what provided the opportunity for me to step away from work and to go back to uni and start that degree. So it was 10 years in marketing. Then I would say, it's now been 20 years in home and study and writing world. But it's been quite interesting for the kids in the last year to suddenly watch me go from, essentially to reinventing myself, to having this second career very much so now. So, yeah.
So talk me through, even though the idea, the seed was planted, say, 10 years ago, you know, at what point did you really think, I'm going to put my bum in the seat and I'm actually going to write a manuscript? And then how long did that take? Because you said that, you know, it can take quite a long time writing, and everyone's different, right? Yes. So what did that look like, and how much of your day or your life was actually writing?
I worked my way up to it. As I said, I did, I was clear that I wanted to write the novel from pretty quickly on. So even as early as 2014 or 2015, I was very clear about that. But I couldn't do much while I was finishing my uni. So I finished at the end of 2016. 2017, I think I just plotted about aimlessly without really knowing what to do with it. I had all these research files everywhere and not much progress happened. And then I think at the beginning of 2018, I booked myself into a hotel for 5 nights and put myself under pressure to say I must start, because I think I was actually scared to start the first chapter. I was actually, that fear of the blank page people talk about, that was definitely me. I'm a real perfectionist. And knowing that, you know, I'd left the family for 5 nights and was spending money on a hotel, that sort of forced me to actually make a start. So ironically, the chapter that I started on there, that got cut in the final draft. but there's a flashback from it. I think it's the chapel scene where there's a line I really like, and it says, you know, if I where is it? It's something about if I timed it just right, and the sun was coming in, that would cast a rainbow at my feet or something. Anyway, I remember liking that line. But so then that's when I finally started. So 2018, and then it was 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 5 solid years.
Wow.
Of research and writing. The first couple of years, I would say I was doing 2 days a week only, doing during school hours. I sort of set aside these 2 days. And then after a while, I thought this progress is just ridiculously slow. And also I'd forget what I was doing. If 5 days had passed and I get back to the computer, I'd spend at least a half a day reorienting myself where I was. So I think for years, 3, 4, and 5, I was doing it as close to full time as I could. So I started to opt out of social things. I was no longer available for mum's cups of tea and things like that during the week. And I think I gave Fridays off. So I was probably doing 4 days a week during school hours.
That is dedicated. Okay. So you do that for, systematically for a number of years, for a period. And then talk to us about your journey to publication, because you are published by Affirm Press, who are doing amazing things at the moment. So how did it come about?
Okay, so we got to the end of 22. I had a finished manuscript, which friends had looked at, but nobody had looked at professionally. It was polished on the line, if you like, but it had plenty of fat in it. And here's the embarrassing part. It was 200,000 words long. I know. I didn't think that was so bad until I spoke to people in the industry and they were outraged. Yeah, I know.
Oh my God.
Well, because there's a lot to the story. And so I thought, we could split it into two and so on. So at the end of that period, I did make a submission to one agent who was very polite, but said no. And maybe the 200,000 words was the big red flag. And I think that does put, I have been told you must never mention that to anybody again, because it shows that you haven't done the work, say, to carve it down to something of a reasonable publishable length. So I had one knockback from an agent, at which point I then went for a manuscript assessment. So I found two people, one in Australia who read just the first 10,000 words, and another manuscript assessor in London who read the entire thing. So there was a bit of financial investment in that on my part. And they both said lots of great, but need to carve the marble very much. So we talked about the option of either cutting it in half, which I didn't like, or splitting it into two, which sounded more palatable to me. So I wanted the split it in two idea. But then what I started doing at that point was then I was starting to refine my pitch, my 3-minute pitch. And I actually did with the Australian Society of Authors. I participated in their 3-minute virtual literary speed pitches. And I picked two publishers, one of whom was Affirm, and I picked them deliberately because they'd published Pip Williams' novel, The Dictionary of Lost Words, and I felt our books had some parallels, and I had really been struck by something Pip had said, where she said, I knew I had a good idea. I just didn't know if I could do it justice. And that was how I felt about my manuscript as well. And so I did those two pitches, but it was all happening at the same time as the manuscript assessing. So it was sort of, it was all together. Both publishers said, yes, please send me your sample chapters. But then I asked for more time so that I could fix my first 50 pages or improve them.
So they wanted how many? They wanted the first 50 pages.
They asked for three. Yeah, it's right. It's about three chapters or 50 odd pages. That's what both of them sort of were after. And so one of the publishers, at a certain point, someone was leaving and they needed me to send them what I had. So I did send them, and I did get a rejection from them.
You send them the whole thing?
No, just 50 pages.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Sorry. And they liked it very much, but they felt at that time it was too literary for them, for that particular publisher. And I kept refining it before I sent it to a firm. And then at the very last moment, I would say in the last week or two, or month maybe, I don't know, I had this epiphany moment where I suddenly thought to myself, I wonder how it would sound if I changed the point of view. So you realize I've been going for like 5+7 years, whatever.
Oh, because you had been writing it in third person, because this is first person. This is Lillian's point of view in first person. And prior to that, you had been writing in third person. Is that correct?
Exactly right. The whole thing was in third. And which I don't know why. That's how it had been all along. And one afternoon, I just tried out a scene and tested it. And I went, oh, my goodness, it's so much better. I got such a shock, and I showed it to the manuscript assessor and she said, yes. And so I rapidly changed those first 50 pages over to first person. And then I sent it to a firm. And then the next day they came back with a really, really great email from Martin Hughes, the, you know, the chief, the head of a firm. And he said, yep, hooked, send me the rest. So yeah.
So you had to quickly rewrite the entire rest of the...
Yes, I did.
Okay, so A, how long did... how long did that take you? But also, then how many bazillion thousand words did you send him, or had you cut it down
by then? Yes, well, I then had to kind of confess how many words were actually really there. And we, I think I still sent it to him all pretty quickly, and I sent him... what did I do? I sent him the whole thing, but only, I think by that point, I think I'd got maybe about, maybe half of it I'd got up to first person by then, because probably, you know, a few weeks had passed while we were going back and forth with emails. So I think he probably got the whole thing, but half of it only in first person. And then we were up to summer by then. We were up to just before Christmas, and they were busy with their publishing schedule. So at that point, I had a very, very enthusiastic publisher, but no actual firm offer or contract. And they said, leave it with us. So I was waiting to hear back from them in the new year. And meanwhile, I just kept plugging away at trying to convert from third to first person. You know,
how many thousand words did you send them?
I think I sent them the whole thing. I think I sent
200,000.
I did.
Oh my God. Okay. So obviously that
I don't now remember what, I don't think that they certainly wouldn't have read all of that. Maybe, you know what? I actually now can't recall. I may have only sent them. No, I think I came up with an earlier endpoint, and I think I might have only sent them about 60,000 words. That's right. That's right. Oh. Sorry. I've just remembered. It's all a bit of a blur because it's been a very busy couple of years.
Yes.
That's right. I picked a satisfying endpoint, which was, I won't say where because it'll give too many spoilers away, but I picked a satisfying endpoint, Lillian's personal journey. And I said, but there's a lot more of the story and I'll keep converting from third to first and then you can have a look at it whenever you're ready. So in fact, yes, no, they actually only saw 60 odd thousand words, all in first person, actually.
Okay. So I hate that when they make you wait over the Christmas New Year period. It drives me actual crazy. I Can't stand it. And I really love it when they come back to you before Christmas, because then you can relax, or at least just know and not be on tender hooks, right? So anyway, what happens in the new year? At some point they get back to you. What happened?
So in late January, I hear from Kelly Doust, who is a firm's commercial publisher who's based in Sydney. And she says she's read my 60-odd thousand pages and she likes it very much and she would like to meet with me for coffee. And I'm going, well, does that mean it's an offer, or does that mean she's going to tell me very nice, but no? But yeah, so we met for coffee. And in fact, that afternoon I had a contract and a letter of offer.
How did you find out? Was it a phone call, an email? What? How did you find out?
It was an email at like a few hours, a couple of hours after I got home. So I thought I was going to be left waiting again. But no, they put me out of my misery quite quickly there, which was probably good, because I was at that point where I was thinking, okay, should I potentially now cast the net, you know, to another publisher? Should I consider getting an agent at this point? I didn't really want to do either, because I felt that if a firm could see the potential in my manuscript, that I was better off to, you know, go with somebody who was really enthusiastic than to do anything else. So they put me out of my misery quickly, and we did the deal.
Describe to me the moment you opened the email. Where were you and what were you thinking?
I was in my study. And there was a lot of squealing, but I think the biggest moment was actually the one a couple months before, when I had sent those first 50 pages and Martin Hughes came back with, like, the email he sent me is just so good that it's literally framed. It's in, I can see it from here. It's framed in my kitchen.
Oh.
It was stuck on my bathroom mirror for a while. I won't say it because it might be private, but I could recite it to you verbatim. I know the entire thing. So, and when I read that, when I saw that email, it was at 9:30 at night. So it's 2nd of November or something. And I started screaming and the children ran into the room and then I hit the floor. I really did.
What do you mean you hit the floor?
Well, I must have thrown myself off the chair and I was on the ground. And I probably don't look like someone who does that, because I am quite calm and restrained normally, but I was beside myself, hysterical. And I kept saying, is it true? Is it really true? And the kids are going, what? What? And
oh my God.
It was seriously as if I had hacked into my own email system and sent myself the email of my dreams. Like, it really was.
Oh my
so
God.
That was my best moment. I have to, possibly one of my top five moments in my whole life. Yeah,
definitely. I absolutely love that. I love that. So, okay. So then obviously you get the contract, you start working with a firm to shape it into a way that, you know, works for both of you. Were there many changes, or what was that process like?
Yeah, that process was really hard. So last year was enormously hard, and I'm honestly still recovering from the toil. It was great, but hard. So what that looked like was, now I recall it, because I had that massive manuscript still and they'd only read, you know, a third of it in a way, I said, all right, would you now read the whole thing and tell me which bits to keep and which to discard? And would we look at two books, or would we look at compacting it? And Kelly said, she said, no, basically, not so simply, but sort of put all the best bits into one. Let's not worry about a second book. You need to work on making the first book as successful as it can be. And she said, so, you know, she felt I was best placed to do the first cut of that. So I had to take the big beast, and I was meant to get it to 100,000 words. I got it to 130. And the way I did that was I put 40,000 aside for a rainy day. We'll see if I come back to that. And then I took 160 down to 130. I gave that to them. That took me between February and June to do that. It was not easy between February.
How did you determine what to chop?
Some of the words went by virtue of changing from third person to first, funnily enough. That actually, I lost some of the words. Then I got rid of excessive historical detail that was probably more for my enjoyment than for the readers, because I did go on a lot of, you know, rabbit hole for, you know, borrowing, which was fun. So I got rid of...
I'm glad you said that because when authors do this, I find sometimes a lot of stuff is in there that is really just to show you that I researched it a lot and I'm a really hard worker, but doesn't necessarily serve the story. But I'm glad you identified that.
It's really hard to part with it though, because, and it's not even that you want to show it, it's actually because you love it so much too, because you do fall in love with those details and then, yeah, you want to share it, but you can't share everything. So, I took out the ones I could bear to lose. And then it was even, you know, just word by word sometimes, like just finding, I mean, I like long sentences, but sometimes there are ways of, if I took out the filler words, for example, you can cut words down. So I tried to improve it. You just say, I improved it. So all those little tips for cutting down words. So, yeah, that's how I got it down to 130. We took it to a firm in June. I think they had it June, July. And came back with the structural edit. So I worked with one of their wonderful young editors called Laura Franks, and together with Kelly. And they came back and gave me a very comprehensive structural edit to really, I guess, highlight the heart of the story. And what, you know, Belinda Alexandra always says, after you get a structural edit, you need to first lie down. And I think I actually lay down for 2 weeks. It's actually very hard when you're faced with major feedback and major changes because you're so close to the manuscript, you just can't see it. So what they wanted me to do, because I'd written, you know, so many decades pass, as you said, and we go through, you know, 5 decades, I'd written chapter by chapter. Sometimes they were close together, sometimes they were far apart. But the feedback was that it was a little bit too episodic and that it would be better to try to compress the timeframes into sort of 3 more distinct areas, I suppose in line with a bit more of a 3-act structure, which I only learned about later. And so what happened was that, I think I can say this without any spoilers, is that we've got a prologue at the beginning which is the fire. And then we go, whereas I had then had my first couple of chapters being a year later, 2 years later, 4 years later, in the finished draft, we go forward, we go 8-year-old Lillian in the prologue, we go then to 16-year-old Lillian. So she's on the cusp of womanhood. And all of those things that I'd wanted to happen in the intervening period, we either made them happen when she was 16 or they reappeared as flashbacks. So lots and lots of the early chapters, not lots, but lots of material went from those early chapters to compress that time frame. Then we went forward and then we went forward again. So there were whole chapters that came out and years that came out. But the flip side of that was that I was also asked to write new material in certain areas. So in the university years, I wrote 2 new chapters. And then in the latter years, there were characters where the feedback was, well, this character is a bit too ghost-like and peripheral. You need to give her some more scenes. So I was cutting dramatically, weaving in flashbacks, and writing new material. And I did that between maybe August and October. It was at most 12 weeks. It might have been 9, 10, I don't know. And I used 2 of those weeks to lie down on the sofa. So,
after lying down, did you actually, what were your thoughts? Did you think, I can't do this or this is too much? Or did you just think, I can do it, but it's going to be the biggest, hardest slog?
Yeah, all of the above, actually all of the above. So, and that's why it was, the feedback was just so hard for me to comprehend. I actually couldn't take it in quickly in order to then come back and suggest counter changes. So that's why I did take a couple of weeks for that. And then I came back and then when I had my head wrapped around it, I then said, okay, yes, I can totally see about compressing the timeframes, all of those things. But, you know, this scene is important. We need to know about this. So let's have like a little mini scene injected or let's have a flashback here. So basically we negotiated a little bit and I slipped some more bits in. I did everything that was asked of me, but I probably did slip in some more scenes. So that 130,000 words that I had given them had come back to me with something like 105 or 110, but with the request for extra scenes. And then after I then implemented all of that, we've ended up with 126,000 words. So wow. It's like a concertina, in, out, in, out.
What an incredible process. Okay, so now this is out and it's just awesome.
Thank you.
And you can ride this way for a while. What you kind of hinted at the next thing that you're doing potentially. What are you working on next?
Yes, well, at the moment I am just working on really trying to make the most of what we've got here. So that's my first step. And then there is more of the story that could be told. So I guess it will depend on how much interest there is from readers. If they want to hear more from Lillian or any of the other characters in there, then I do have more to say about it. So that's, you know, that's one option. Another option is that, as you would know from later in the chapters, I've got a big interest in art, and you can see from behind me. And, you know, on the inside pages of the book, as you know, we've got the Russell Drysdale painting and so on. And so I love the art world, so possibly I would write something that sort of exists in the Australian art world. And the third possibility probably comes from my parents' background being immigrants to Australia in the 60s. I could explore something in there. So, you know, there are a few ideas buzzing around in there. I'm not sure which one to go with yet, and it might come down to the reception to this novel. So we'll see.
But I have no doubt the reception is going to be incredible. I mean,
I hope so. That's very nice to hear. Thank you.
You should just enjoy it. Don't even worry about the next one then. Just enjoy it. All right. So let's wrap up with, what then are your top three tips for aspiring writers who, you know, would love to be in your position one day where they get that email from the publisher?
Yes, well, I do think the first tip is to read. And I think, you know, to write well, you must read well. And I think you read analytically and look at what you like about a certain novelist or a book. Look at how it's written, what point of view it's written in. So, you know, reading. Second tip, I mean, there are so many things I could say, but I think building a writing community is really important. So surrounding yourself with a few good buddies, and I had several of them who were mentioned in the back of my book as well. So surround yourself with people who are on the same journey, and ideally have at least one or two people that you know who are actually published authors to remind yourself that it's actually possible. So I was lucky enough to have Leanne Moriarty as a friend. So that was like inspiring on one level. On the other hand, it's not great because then all our friends would sort of go, oh, you know, when you like Leanne, I'm like, no one is like Leanne, you know, you're like, so anyway, so that's the second tip. And I'm just trying to think, I think, yeah, doing targeted courses to complement the skills that you have already. So, and, you know, just remember it too, at the end of the day, they're all just words on a page, and don't be a perfectionist, just work on them, and you can always change them and just keep writing, really.
Thank you so much. So inspiring. Everyone, get yourself a copy of The Story Thief by Kira Geddes. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Valerie. It's been such a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Kira as much as I did. Now, I wanted to leave you with this fun fact before you go. Did you know that there are some words or phrases in English that can only be used in a positive way? And these are called positive polarity items. Almost sounds like something you'd find in physics or something about magnets or something, you know, not linguistics. But anyway, here's an example. The word somewhat. Somewhat is a positive polarity item. So you can say, I liked his latest book somewhat, but you can't really say, I didn't like his latest book somewhat. And if we have positive polarity, you may be wondering if we have negative polarity. Well, the answer is yes. So, an example, You can say, I didn't sleep a wink last night. But you can't really say, I slept a wink last night. There you go. Positive polarity and negative polarity. It was great to hang out with you this week. And of course, do join the listener community on Facebook. Just search for So You Want to Be a Writer podcast community on Facebook and request to join. It's free to join. And also feel free to connect with me on social media. I'm at Valerie Koo on Twitter and Instagram and over at valeriekoo.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. And I look forward to chatting to you again next time. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. If you're serious about completing your own novel manuscript, immerse yourself in our inspiring and motivational six-month program, Write Your Novel. Filled with weekly workshopping and practical lessons, you'll receive advice on structure, dialogue, and much more, as well as tips on publishing. The online program fits around your weekly schedule, and you'll get extensive personal feedback from your classmates and tutor throughout the program. Let's hear from Sarah Clutton.
Hi, I'm Sarah Clutton. I've written two novels that are domestic suspense novels, and I've done several courses at the Australian Writers' Centre. I sort of got to a stage in my life where I hit middle age, so I thought I'll start writing a novel, and one day I woke up in the middle of the night and this idea for a novel dropped into my head. I got about 40,000 words into that novel and I realised I didn't know how to write a novel. I tried to take apart a lot of the novels I'd read and realised that I needed more help. I did it online because I live in a country town, so the online course suited me perfectly. The practical workshopping and all of the wonderful feedback we got from the other participants in the course was really excellent. I still workshop with a girl I met through that course who is a writer living in Stockholm. So that's been a wonderful collaboration as well. You learn so much about the inside business. What is really important in terms of flagging to potential publishers, you know, it's really difficult to teach yourself things when you're not in an industry. You don't know what you don't know. My friend in Sweden had been to the Stockholm Book Festival and she had some great experience listening to some publishers from Bookature, who are an arm of Hachette UK. They are one of the few that take direct submissions. So I just sent it off to Bookature knowing that they had a great reputation, and within 2 weeks I'd heard that they wanted to work with me. I got a two-book deal with them and they were brilliant. So my first book is Good Little Liars. It's a mystery. It's set in Tasmania. The Write Your Novel course was brilliant. And certainly I know that without it I wouldn't have gotten a book deal. So through the Australian Writers' Centre, I've discovered that to write a novel, it can take a village. So it's a bit like raising a child. You're sometimes too close to your own work, and taking away the ego from your work and having it stripped down in all its flaws and workshopped can make it so much better. And I've also learned that writing is an ongoing process of learning. So you can never learn enough, and there's always something else to learn.
Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/novelwriting.